I think the point is clear. This task dwarfs the ongoing Human Genome Project, whose purpose is to scan and record the complete human genetic code contained in microscopic strands of human DNA. This is a multi-billion-dollar endeavor, being carried out over at least a decade and requiring dedicated resources in many laboratories around the world. So you might imagine that I am mentioning it simply to add to the transporter implausibility checklist. However, while the challenge is daunting, I think this is one area that could possibly be up to snuff in the 23rd century. One might expect that 210 years from now, at the dawn of the 23rd century, we will have the computer technology on hand to meet the information transfer challenge of the transporter. I say this, of course, without any idea of how. The emerging notions of biological computers, in which molecular dynamics mimics digital logical processes, and the particles in a macroscopic sample all act simultaneously, seem to me to be the most promising in this regard. Now for some additional cold water of reality. Two words. Quantum mechanics. At the microscopic level necessary to scan and recreate matter in the transporter, the laws of physics are governed by the strange and exotic laws of quantum mechanics, whereby particles can act like waves and waves can behave like particles. I'm not going to give a course in quantum mechanics here. However, the bottom line is as follows. On microscopic scales, that which is being observed and that which is doing the observation cannot be separated. To make a measurement is to alter a system, usually forever. This simple law can be parameterized in many different ways, but is probably most famous in the form of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. This fundamental law, which appears to do away with the classical notion of determinism in physics, although in fact at a fundamental level it doesn't, divides the physical world into two sets of observable quantities, the yin and the yang, if you like. It tells us that no matter what technology is invented in the future, it is impossible to measure certain combinations of observables with arbitrarily high accuracy. On microscopic scales, one might measure the position of a particle arbitrarily well. However, Heisenberg tells us that we can then not know its velocity, and hence precisely where it will be in the next instant very well at all. Or we might ascertain the energy state of an atom with arbitrary precision. Yet in this case, we cannot determine exactly how long it will remain in this state. The list goes on. These relations are at the heart of quantum mechanics, and they will never go away. As long as we work on a scale where the laws of quantum mechanics apply, we are stuck with them. There is a slightly flawed yet very satisfying physical argument that gives some heuristic understanding of the uncertainty principle. Quantum mechanics endows all particles with a wave-like behavior, and waves have one striking property. They are disturbed only when they encounter objects larger than their wavelength, the distance between successive crests. You have only to observe water waves in the ocean to see this behavior explicitly. A pebble protruding from the surface of the water will have no effect on the pattern of the surf pounding the shore. However, a large boulder will leave a region of calm water in its wake. So, if we want to illuminate an atom, that is, bounce light off it so that we can see where it is, we have to shine light of a wavelength small enough so that it will be disturbed by the atom. However, the laws of quantum mechanics tell us that waves of light come in small packets, or quanta, which we call photons, as in Starship photon torpedoes, which are in fact not made of photons at all. The individual photons of each wavelength have an energy inversely related to their wavelength. The greater the resolution we want, the smaller the wavelength of the light we must use. But the smaller the wavelength, the larger the energy of the packets. If we bombard an atom with high-energy photons in order to observe it, we may ascertain exactly where the atom was when the photon hit it. But the observation process itself, that is, hitting the atom with the photons, will clearly transfer significant energy to the atom, thus changing its speed and direction of motion by some amount. It is therefore impossible to resolve atoms and their energy configurations with the accuracy necessary to recreate exactly a human pattern. Residual uncertainty in some of the observables is inevitable. What this would mean for the accuracy of the final product after transport is a detailed biological question I can only speculate upon. This problem was not lost on the Star Trek writers, who were aware of the inevitable constraints of quantum mechanics on the transporter. Possessing something physicists can't usually call upon, namely artistic license, they introduced Heisenberg compensators, which allow quantum resolution of objects. When an interviewer asked the Star Trek technical consultant, Michael Okuda, how Heisenberg compensators worked, he merely replied, "Very well, thank you." Heisenberg compensators perform another useful plot function. One may wonder, as I have, why the transporter is not also a replicator of life forms. After all, a replicator exists on board starships that allows glasses of water or wine to magically appear in each crew member's quarters on voice command. Well, it seems that replicator technology can operate only at molecular level resolution and not quantum resolution. This is supposed to explain why replication of living beings is not possible. It may also explain why the crew continually complains that the replicator food is never quite the same as the real thing, and why Riker, among others, prefers to cook omelets and other delicacies the old-fashioned way. One last challenge to transporting, as if one were needed. Beaming down is hard enough, but beaming up may even be more difficult. In order to transport a crew member back to the ship, the sensors aboard the Enterprise have to be able to spot the crew member on the planet below. More than that, they need to scan the individual prior to dematerialization and matter stream transport. So the Enterprise must have a telescope powerful enough to resolve objects on and often underneath a planet's surface at atomic resolution. In fact, we are told that the normal operating range for the transporter is approximately 40,000 kilometers, or about 3 times the Earth's diameter. This is the number we shall use for the following estimate. Everyone has seen photographs of the domes of the world's great telescopes, like the Keck Telescope in Hawaii, the world's largest, or the Mount Palomar Telescope in California. Have you ever wondered why bigger and bigger telescopes are designed? It's not just an obsession with bigness, as some people, including many members of Congress, like to accuse science of. Just as larger accelerators are needed if we wish to probe the structure of matter on ever smaller scales, larger telescopes are needed if we want to resolve celestial objects that are fainter and farther away. The reasoning is simple. Because of the wave nature of light, any time it passes through an opening, it tends to diffract or spread out a little bit. When the light from a distant point source goes through a telescope lens, the image will be spread out somewhat, so that instead of seeing a point source, you will see a small, blurred disk of light. Now, if 2 point sources are closer together across the line of sight than the size of their respective disks, it will be impossible to resolve them as separate objects, since their disks will overlap in the observed image. Astronomers call such disks seeing disks. The bigger the lens, the smaller the seeing disk. Thus, to resolve smaller and smaller objects, telescopes must have bigger and bigger lenses. In any case, one can perform a calculation, given that the Enterprise is using radiation with a wavelength of less than a billionth of a centimeter and scanning an object 40,000 kilometers away with atomic scale resolution. I find that in order to do this, the ship would need a telescope with a lens greater than approximately 50,000 kilometers in diameter. Were it any smaller, there would be no possible way, even in principle, to resolve single atoms. I think it is fair to say that while the Enterprise D is one large mother, it is not that large. As promised, thinking about transporters has led us into quantum mechanics, particle physics, computer science, Einstein's mass-energy relation, and even the existence of the human soul. We should therefore not be too disheartened by the apparent impossibility of building a device to perform the necessary functions. Or, to put it less negatively, building a transporter would require us to heat up matter to a temperature 1,000,000 times the temperature at the center of the sun, expend more energy in a single machine than all of humanity presently uses, build telescopes larger than the size of the Earth, improve present computers by a factor of 1,000,000,000,000,000,000, and avoid the laws of quantum mechanics. It's no wonder that Lieutenant Barclay was terrified of beaming. I think even Gene Roddenberry, if faced with this challenge in real life, would probably choose instead to budget for a landable starship. When Humphrey Bogart said to Ingrid Bergman at the Casablanca airport, "We'll always have Paris," he meant, of course, the memory of Paris. when Picard said something similar to Janice Menheim at the holodeck recreation of the Café des Artistes, he may have intended it more literally. Thanks to the holodeck, memories can be relived, favorite places revisited, and lost loves rediscovered. Almost. The holodeck is one of the most fascinating pieces of technology aboard the Enterprise. To anyone already familiar with the nascent world of virtual reality, either through video games or the more sophisticated, high-speed modern computers, the possibilities offered by the holodeck are particularly enticing. Who wouldn't want to enter completely into his or her own fantasy world at a moment's notice? It is so seductive, in fact, that I have little doubt that it would be far more addictive than it is made out to be in the series. We get some inkling of holodeck addiction, or holodiction, in the episodes Hollow Pursuits and Galaxy's Child. In Hollow Pursuits, everyone's favorite neurotic officer, Lieutenant Reginald Barclay, becomes addicted to his fantasy vision of the senior officers aboard the Enterprise, and would rather interact with them on the holodeck than anywhere else on the ship. In Galaxy's Child, when Geordi LaForge, who has begun a relationship with a holodeck representation of Dr. Leah Brahms, the designer of the ship's engines, meets the real Dr. Brahms, things become complicated. Given the rather cerebral pastimes the crew generally engage in on the holodeck, one may imagine that the hormonal instincts driving 20th century humanity have evolved somewhat by the 23rd century, although if this is the case, Will Riker is not representative of his peers. Based on what I know of the world of today, I would have expected that sex would almost completely drive the holodeck. Indeed, the holodeck would give safe sex a whole new meaning. I'm not being facetious here. The holodeck represents what is so enticing about fantasy, particularly sexual fantasy, actions without consequences, pleasure without pain, and situations that can be repeated and refined at will. The possible hidden pleasures of the holodeck are merely alluded to from time to time in the series. For example, after Geordi has barged in rather rudely on Reg's private holodeck fantasy, he admits, "I've spent a few hours on the holodeck myself." Now, as far as I'm concerned, what you do on the holodeck is your own business, as long as it doesn't interfere with your work. If that doesn't sound like a 20th century admonition against letting the pleasures of the flesh get the better of one, I don't know what does. The danger that we will become a nation of couch potatoes would not apply in a world full of personal holodecks, or perhaps holodecks down at the mall. Engaging in holodeck play is far from passive. However, I still find the prospect of virtual reality worrisome, because though it appears real, it is much less scary than real life. The attraction of a world of direct sensual experience without consequences could be overwhelming. The holodeck does differ in one striking way from most of the virtual reality technologies currently under development. At present, through the use of devices that you strap on and that influence your vision and sensory input, virtual reality is designed to put the scene inside you. The holodeck takes a more inventive tack. It puts you inside the scene. It does this in part by inventive use of holography and in part by replication. The principles on which holography is based were first elucidated in 1947, well before the technology was available to fully exploit it. By now, most people are familiar with the use of three-dimensional holographic images on credit cards. The word hologram derives from the Greek words for whole and to write. Unlike normal photographs, which merely record two-dimensional representations of three-dimensional reality, holograms give you the whole picture. In fact, it is possible with holography to recreate a three-dimensional image that you can walk around and view from all sides as if it were the original object. The only way to tell the difference is to try touching it. Only then will you find that there is nothing there to touch. How can a two-dimensional piece of film, which is what stores the holographic image, record the full information of a three-dimensional image? To answer this, we have to think a little about exactly what it is we see when we see something, and what a photograph actually records. We see objects either because they emit or reflect light, which then arrives at our eyes. When a three-dimensional object is illuminated, it scatters light in many different directions because of its three-dimensionality. If we could somehow reproduce the exact pattern of divergent light created when light is scattered by the actual object, then our eyes would not be able to distinguish the difference between the actual object and the divergent light pattern sans object. By moving our head, for example, we would be able to see the features that were previously obscured, because the entire pattern of scattered light from all parts of the object would have been recreated. How can we first store and then later recreate all this information? We can gain some insight into this question by thinking about what a normal photograph, which stores and later recreates two-dimensional images, actually records. When we take a picture, we expose a light-sensitive material to the incoming light, which arrives through the lens of the camera. This light-sensitive material, when exposed to various chemicals, will darken in proportion to the intensity of the light that impinged upon it. I am discussing black and white film here, but the extension to color film is simple. One just coats the film with three different substances, each of which is sensitive to a different primary color of light. So, the total information content recorded on a photographic film is the intensity of light arriving at each point on the film. When we develop the film, those points on it that were exposed to a greater intensity of light will react with the development chemicals to become darker, while those not so exposed will remain lighter. The resulting image on the film is a negative two-dimensional projection of the original light field. We can project light through this negative onto a light-sensitive sheet of paper to create the final photograph. When we look at it, light hitting the lighter areas of the photograph will be predominantly reflected, while light hitting the darker areas will be absorbed. Looking at the light reflected from the photograph produces a two-dimensional intensity pattern on our retinas, which then allows us to interpret this pattern. The question then becomes, what more is there to record than just the intensity of light at each point? Once again, we rely on the fact that light is a wave. Because of this fact, more than just intensity is needed to characterize its complete configuration. To record all the information about the light waves scattered by a three-dimensional object, you have to find a way of recording on a piece of film both the intensity and the phase, or position of the crests of each wave, of the scattered light. This is simple to do. If you split a light beam into two parts and shine one part directly onto the film and let the other part scatter off the object before illuminating the film, then either one of two things can happen. If the two light waves are in phase, that is, both have crests coinciding at some point A, then the amplitude of the resulting wave at A will be twice the amplitude of either individual wave. On the other hand, if the two waves are out of phase at point A, then they will cancel each other out, and the resulting wave at A will have zero amplitude. So now, if the film at point A is photographic film, which records intensity only, the pattern recorded will be the interference pattern of the two waves, the reference beam, and the beam of light scattered by the object. This pattern contains not only the information about the intensity of the scattered light from the object, but information about its phases as well. If one is clever, one can extract this information to recreate a three-dimensional image of the object that scattered the light. In fact, it turns out that one doesn't have to be all that clever. If one merely illuminates this photographic film with a source of light of the same wavelength as the original light that produced the interference pattern, an image of the object will be created exactly where the object was in relation to the film when you look through the film. If you move your head to one side, you will be able to look around the edges of the recreated object. If you cover up most of the piece of film and hold it closer to your eyes and look through the uncovered part, you will still see the entire object. In this sense, the experience is just like looking through a window at a scene outdoors, except that the scene you are seeing isn't really there. The light coming to your eyes through the film is affected in just such a way as to make your eyes believe that it has been scattered off objects, which you then see. This is a hologram. One can arrange, just as one can using various lenses, for the image of the objects you see to appear to be between you and the film, and you will see before you the three-dimensional image of an object which you can walk around and view from all sides. Or you can arrange for the light source to be in front of the film instead of behind it, as in the holograms on credit cards. Presumably, the sort of hologram in which images are projected in front of the film is used on the holodeck, and to recreate the image of a doctor in the sick bay, as in the Voyager series. What's more, in order to create such holograms, one would not need to use the original objects to make the holographic images. Digital computers are now sophisticated enough to do ray tracing, That is, they can calculate the pattern of light scattered from any hypothetical object you want to draw on the screen, and illuminate it from any angle. In the same way, the computer could determine the configuration of the interference pattern that would be caused by merging the light from a direct beam with the scattered light from an object. This computer-generated interference pattern could be projected onto a transparent screen, and when this screen is illuminated from behind, a three-dimensional image is produced of an object that in fact never existed. If the computer is fast enough, it can project a continuously changing interference pattern on the screen, thereby producing a moving three-dimensional image. So the holographic aspect of the holodeck is not particularly far-fetched. However, holograms aren't all there is to the holodeck. As noted, they have no corporeal integrity. You can walk through one or shoot through one, as was evidenced by the wonderful holographic representations created by Spock and Data to trick the Romulans in the episode Unification. This incorporeal reality simply will not do for the objects one would like to interact with, that is, touch, on the holodeck. Here, techniques that are more esoteric are required, and the Star Trek writers have turned to the transporter, or at least to the replicators, which are less sophisticated versions of the transporter. Presumably, using transporter technology, matter is replicated and moved around on the holodeck to resemble exactly the beings in question, in careful coordination with computer programs that control the voices and movements of the recreated beings. Similarly, the replicators could reproduce the inanimate objects in the scene, tables, chairs, and so forth. This holodeck matter owes its form to the pattern held in the replicator buffer. When the transporter is turned off, or if the object is removed from the holodeck, the matter can then disassemble as easily as it would if the pattern buffer were turned off during the beaming process. Thus, creatures created from holodeck matter can be trapped on the holodeck, as the fictional detectives Cyrus Redblock and Felix Leach found to their dismay in the Next Generation episode, The Big Goodbye, and as Sherlock Holmes's nemesis, Professor Moriarty, surmised and then attempted to overcome in several other episodes. So here is how I envisage the holodeck. Holograms would be effective around the walls to give one the impression of being in a three-dimensional environment that extended to the horizon. And the transporter-based replicators would then create the moving solid objects within the scene. Since holography is realistic, while transporters are not, one would have to find some other way of molding and moving matter around in order to make a workable holodeck. Still, one out of two technologies in hand isn't bad. Where does all this leave the pure holograms, like the holographic Doctor of the Voyager series? The answer is, absolutely nowhere. With just the scattered light and no matter around, I'm afraid that these images would not be very effective at lifting, manipulating, or probing. However, a good bedside manner and compassionate words of advice, which are at the heart of good medical practice, can be dispensed by a hologram as easily as by the real thing. In the course of more than 13 TV years of the various Star Trek series, the writers have had the opportunity to tap into some of the most exciting ideas from all fields of physics. Sometimes they get it right, sometimes they blow it. Sometimes they use just the words that physicists use, and sometimes they incorporate the ideas associated with them. I thought it might be useful to make a brief presentation of some of the more interesting ideas from modern physics which the Star Trek writers have borrowed. In particular, concepts I haven't concentrated on elsewhere on the tape. After this discussion, I'll sample the most blatant physics blunders in the series. I've restricted my list to the top 10 examples. There are a lot more to choose from. 1. The scale of the galaxy and the universe. Our galaxy is the stage on which the Star Trek drama is enacted. Throughout the series, galactic distance scales of various sorts play a crucial role in the action. Units from AUs, for astronomical unit, which were used to describe the size of the V'ger cloud in the first Star Trek movie, to light years are bandied about. One astronomical unit is 93 million miles, the distance from the Earth to the Sun. In addition, various features of our galaxy are proposed, including a Great Barrier at the center in Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, and in the original series, a Galactic Barrier at the Edge. It seems appropriate, therefore, in order to describe the playing field where Star Trek's action takes place, to offer our own present picture of the galaxy and its neighbors and of distant scales in the universe. Because of the large number of digits required, one rarely expresses astronomical distances in conventional units such as miles or kilometers. Instead, astronomers have created several fiducial lengths that seem more appropriate. One such unit is the AU, the distance between the Earth and the Sun. This is the characteristic distance scale of our solar system, with Pluto, the Ultima Thule, being nearly 40 AU from the Sun. In Star Trek, the motion picture, the V'ger cloud is described as 82 AU in diameter, which is remarkably big, bigger than the size of our solar system. For comparison with interstellar distances, it is useful to express the Earth-Sun distance in terms of the time it takes light, or the time it would take the Enterprise at warp 1, to travel from the Sun to the Earth, about 8 minutes. This should be the time it would take light to travel to most Class M planets from their suns. So, we can say that an AU is 8 light minutes. By comparison, the distance to the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, a binary star system where the inventor of the warp drive, Zefram Cochrane, apparently lived, is about 4 light years. This is a characteristic distance between stars in our region of the galaxy. It would take rockets, at their present rate of speed, more than 10,000 years to travel from here to Alpha Centauri. At warp 9, which is about 1,500 times the speed of light, it would take about 6 hours to traverse 1 light year. The distance of the Sun from the center of the galaxy is approximately 25,000 light years. At warp 9, it would take almost 15 years to traverse this distance, so it is unlikely that Cybok, having commandeered the Enterprise, would have been able to take her to the galactic center, as he did in Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, unless the Enterprise was essentially already there. The Milky Way is a spiral galaxy, with a large central disk of stars. It is approximately 100,000 light-years across and a few thousand light-years deep. The Voyager, tossed 70,000 light-years from Earth in the first episode of that series, would thus indeed be on the other side of the galaxy. At warp 9, the ship would take about 50 years to return to the neighborhood of our Sun from that distance. At the center of our galaxy is a large galactic bulge, a dense conglomeration of stars several thousand light-years across. It is thought to harbor a black hole of about 1 million solar masses. Black holes ranging from 100,000 to more than 1 billion solar masses are likely at the center of many galaxies. A rough, spherical halo of very old stars surrounds the galaxy. The conglomerations of thousands of stars called globular clusters found here are thought to be among the oldest objects in our galaxy, perhaps as old as 18 billion years, according to our current methods of dating. More ancient, even, than the black cluster in the episode Hero Worship, which is said to be 9 billion years old. An even larger spherical halo, consisting of dark matter, is thought to encompass the galaxy. This halo is invisible to all types of telescopes. Its existence is inferred from the motion of stars and gas in the galaxy, and it may well contain 10 times as much mass as the observable galaxy. The Milky Way is an average-sized spiral galaxy, containing a few 100 billion stars. There are approximately 100 billion galaxies in the observable universe, each containing more or less that many stars. Of the galaxies we see, roughly 70% are spiral, the rest are somewhat spherical in shape, and are known as elliptical galaxies. The largest of these are giant ellipticals, more than 10 times as massive as the Milky Way. Most galaxies are clustered in groups. In our local group, the nearest galaxies to the Milky Way are small satellite galaxies orbiting our own. These objects, observable in the southern hemisphere, are called the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds. It is about 6 million light-years to the nearest large galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy, home to the Kelvins, who attempt to take over the Enterprise and return to their home galaxy in the original series episode, By Any Other Name. At warp 9, that voyage would take approximately 4,000 years. Because of the time it takes light to travel, as we observe farther and farther out, we are also observing farther and farther back in time. The farthest we can now observe with electromagnetic sensors is back to a time when the universe was about 300,000 years old. Before then, matter existed as a hot, ionized gas opaque to electromagnetic radiation. When we look out in all directions, we see the radiation emitted when matter and radiation finally decoupled. This is known as the cosmic microwave background. Observing it, most recently with the COBE satellite launched by NASA in 1989, we get a picture of what the universe looked like when it was only about 300,000 years old. Finally, the universe itself is expanding uniformly. As a result, distant galaxies are observed to be receding from us, and the farther away they are, the faster they are receding, at a rate directly proportional to their distance from us. This rate of expansion, characterized by a quantity called the Hubble constant, is such that galaxies located 10 million light-years from us are moving away at an average rate of about 150 to 300 kilometers per second. Working backward, we find that all the observed galaxies in the universe would converge about 10 to 20 billion years ago at the time of the Big Bang. 2. Dark matter. As I mentioned earlier, our galaxy is apparently immersed in a vast sea of invisible material. By studying the motion of the stars, of hydrogen gas clouds, and even of the large and small Magellanic clouds around the galactic center, and using Newton's laws relating the velocity of orbiting objects to the mass pulling them, it has been determined that there is a roughly spherical halo of dark material stretching out to distances perhaps 10 times as far from the center of the galaxy as we are. This material accounts for at least 90% of the mass of the Milky Way. As we observe the motions of other galaxies, including the ellipticals, and also the motion of groups of galaxies, we find there is far more matter associated with these systems than we can account for on the basis of the observable material. The entire observable universe, therefore, seems to be dominated by dark matter. It is currently believed that between 90 and 99% of the mass of the universe is made of this material. The notion of dark matter has crept into both the Next Generation and the Voyager series, and in an amusing way. For example, in the Voyager episode Cathexis, the ship enters a dark matter nebula, which, as you might imagine, is like a dark cloud so that you cannot see into it. The Enterprise had already encountered similar objects, including the black cluster mentioned earlier. However, the salient fact about dark matter is not that it shields light in any way, but that it does not shine, that is, emit radiation, and does not even absorb significant amounts of radiation. If it did either, it would be detectable by telescopes. If you were inside a dark matter cloud, as we probably are, you would not even see it. The question of the nature, origin, and distribution of dark matter is probably one of the most exciting unresolved issues in cosmology today. Since this unknown material dominates the mass density of the universe, its distribution must have determined how and when the observable matter gravitationally collapsed to create the galactic clusters, galaxies, stars, and planets that make the universe so interesting to us. Our very existence is directly dependent on this material. The amount of dark matter in the universe will determine the universe's eventual fate, whether it ends in a bang by recollapsing, or an endless whimper by continuing to expand even as the stars eventually burn out. The future will depend on how much matter, of whatever sort, the universe contains, since gravitational attraction is what slows the expansion. Even more interesting are the strong arguments that the dark matter may be made of particles completely different from the protons and neutrons that make up normal matter. Independent limits on the amount of normal matter in the universe, based on calculations of nuclear reaction rates in the early universe and the subsequent formation of light elements, suggests that there may not be enough protons and neutrons to account for the dark matter around galaxies and clusters. In order for the small fluctuations in the initial distribution of matter to have collapsed in the hot plasma of the early universe to form the galaxies and clusters we observe today, some new type of elementary particle, of a kind that does not interact with electromagnetic radiation, had to be involved. If the dark matter is indeed made of some new type of elementary particle, then the dark matter is not just out there, it is in this room as you are listening to this tape, passing imperceptibly through your body. These exotic elementary particles would not clump into astronomical objects. They would form a diffuse gas streaming throughout the galaxy. Since they interact at best only very weakly with matter, they would be able to sail through objects as big as the Earth. Indeed, examples of such particles already exist in nature, notably neutrinos, particles that should be familiar to Trekkers. The dark matter might be detected directly here on Earth using sophisticated elementary particle detection techniques. Various detectors designed with a sensitivity to various dark matter candidates are currently being constructed. The detections of such particles might revolutionize elementary particle physics. It is quite likely that these objects are remnants of production processes in the very early universe, before it was 1 second old, and would then be related to physics at energy scales beyond those we can directly probe using modern accelerators. Of course, as exciting as this possibility is, we are not yet certain that the dark matter may not be made of less exotic stuff. There are many ways of putting protons and neutrons together so that they do not shine. Perhaps the most plausible possibility for this scenario is that there are many objects in the galaxy which are almost large enough to be stars, but are too small for nuclear reactions to start occurring in their cores. Such objects are known as brown dwarfs, and Data and his colleagues aboard the Enterprise have discussed them, for example, in the episode Manhunt. In fact, there are interesting experiments going on right now to find out whether or not brown dwarfs, known in this context as MACHOs, for Massive Astrophysical Compact Halo Objects, make up a significant component of the dark matter halo around the Milky Way galaxy. While these objects are not directly observable, if one of them were to pass in front of a star, the star's light would be affected by the MACHO's gravity in such a way as to make the star appear brighter. This gravitational lensing phenomenon was first predicted by Einstein back in the 1930s, and we now have the technology to detect it. Several experiments are observing literally millions of stars in our galaxy each night to see if this lensing phenomenon takes place. The sensitivity is sufficient to detect a dark matter halo of MACHOs, if they do indeed make up most of the dark matter surrounding our galaxy. Preliminary data have set upper limits that tend to suggest that the dark matter halo is not composed of MACHOs, but the question is still open. 3. Neutron stars. These objects are all that is left of the collapsed cores of massive stars that have undergone a supernova. Although they typically contain a mass somewhat in excess of the mass of our Sun, they are so compressed that they are about the size of Manhattan. Once again, the Star Trek writers have outdone themselves in the nomenclature department. The Enterprise has several times encountered material expelled from a neutron star, a material that the writers have dubbed neutronium. Since neutron stars are composed almost entirely of neutrons held so tightly together that the star is basically one huge atomic nucleus, the name is a good one. Of course, such material can only exist under the incredibly high pressure present in a neutron star. The Enterprise has had several close calls near neutron stars. In the episode Evolution, when the nanites began eating the ship's computers, the crew was in the act of studying a neutron star that was apparently about to erupt as it accreted material. In the episode The Masterpiece Society, the Enterprise must deflect a stellar core fragment hurtling towards Moab 4. There are no doubt millions of neutron stars in the galaxy. Most of these are born with incredibly large magnetic fields inside them. If they are spinning rapidly, they make wonderful radio beacons. Radiation is emitted from each of their poles, and if the magnetic field is tilted with respect to the spin axis, a rotating beacon is created. On Earth, we detect these periodic bursts of radio waves and call their sources pulsars. Rotating out in space, they make the best clocks in the universe. The pulsar signals can keep time to better than 1 microsecond per year. Moreover, some pulsars produce more than 1,000 pulses per second. This means that an object that is essentially a huge atomic nucleus with the mass of the Sun and 10 to 20 kilometers across is rotating over 1,000 times each second. Think about that. The rotation speed at the neutron star's surface is therefore almost half the speed of light. Pulsars are one illustration of the fact that nature produces objects more remarkable than any the Star Trek writers are likely to invent. 4. Anions. In the Next Generation episode, The Next Phase, a transporter mix-up with a new Romulan cloaking device that puts matter out of phase with other matter causes Geordi LaForge and Ro Laren to vanish. They are presumed dead and remain invisible and incommunicado until Data modifies an anion emitter for another purpose and miraculously dephases them. In the three-dimensional space in which we live, elementary particles are designated as fermions or bosons, depending upon their spin. We associate with each variety of elementary particle a quantum number, which gives the value of its spin. This number can be an integer, like 0, 1, or 2, or a half integer, like 1 half, 3 halves, or 5 halves. Particles with integer spin are called bosons, and particles with half integer spin are called fermions. The quantum mechanical behavior of fermions and bosons is different. When two identical fermions are interchanged, the quantum mechanical wave function describing their properties is multiplied by minus 1. Whereas in an interchange of bosons, nothing happens to the wave function. Therefore, two fermions can never be in the same place, because if they were, interchanging them would leave the configuration identical, but the wave function would have to be multiplied by minus 1, and the only thing that can be multiplied by minus 1 and remain the same is 0. Thus, the wave function must vanish. This is the origin of the famous Pauli exclusion principle, originally applied to electrons, which states that two identical fermions cannot occupy the same quantum mechanical state. In any case, it turns out that if one allows particles to move in only two dimensions, as the two-dimensional beings encountered by the Enterprise are forced to do, or, more relevantly, as happens in the real world, when atomic configurations in a crystal are arranged so that the electrons, say, travel only in a two-dimensional plane, the standard quantum mechanical rules that apply in three-dimensional space are changed. Spin is no longer quantized, and particles can carry any value for this quantity. Hence, instead of fermions or bosons, one can have anyons. This was the origin of the name. Back to the Star Trek writers. What I find amusing is that the number by which the wave function of particles is multiplied when particles are interchanged is called a phase. Fermion wave functions are multiplied by a phase of minus 1, while bosons are multiplied by a phase of 1, and hence remain the same. Anyons are multiplied by a combination of 1 and an imaginary number. Imaginary numbers are the square roots of negative numbers. And hence anyons, in a real sense, are out of phase with normal particles. So it seems fitting that an anyon emitter would change the phase of something, doesn't it?